My name is Midge Dector. I used to be an editor on magazines and in book publishing. Now I am the director of the Committee for the Free World. The reason that I went from something so interesting as being an editor to something so hard to describe as being the organizer of a committee is that through the late 1960s and even more in the 1970s, I was growing distressed, and not only I, but many, many people around me, friends and associates, growing extremely distressed by the condition of the American intellectual community, by its hatred for the values and the virtues of American society, by its repeated efforts to undermine everything most important about this society, particularly, alas, our children. Now, what I mean by the intellectual community is something very simple. I mean academics, journalists, writers, artists, people who make a living from ideas and from the manipulation of words. They are very important people in any society. More important, I think, than most of our political leaders have understood. Mikhail Gorbachev understands how important intellectuals are. He is madly courting them at this moment. That is something that no American president has yet learned to do, with the possible exception of Jack Kennedy. In any case, these people have an enormous effect and impact on the general climate in this country, and for decades had increasingly been devoting themselves to attacks on the United States, on its political system, on its social system, on its freedoms. It called these a sham. It was very distressing, and it was more than distressing to most of us. It was something we all considered extremely ugly. Ungrateful. There's nothing uglier than ingratitude. And there never was a group of people better treated, certainly never a group of writers better treated by the political system and the economic system and the general conditions of the society in which they lived than the writers and teachers and artists in the United States. And on the one hand, we couldn't understand, not really, not deep down, we couldn't understand why they hate this country so much. And on the other hand, we felt they were posing a very, very great danger, because no country can long survive a condition in which its culture will give it no sustenance and no blessing. And so we decided, I guess it's not exactly proportionate kind of decision to make or proportionate activity to undertake, but we decided that we would try to gather together a group of all the people who, like us, felt that we ought to be down on our knees in gratitude that in this world we live in the late 20th century, we should be down on our knees in gratitude for the United States of America, not only for what it was doing for us, but for what it represented as a resistance to the forces of tyranny and misery and oppression in the world. And so we decided, what do people do when they want to engage in fights? They organize a committee. And that's what the Committee for the Free World is. And I am its director.
Well, changing from editor to, I would say, advocate, is quite a step. What was the most difficult part of that change?
Well, It is quite a step, indeed. In fact, it's like a 180-degree turn from being an editor to being an advocate. An editor is not supposed to be an advocate. That's the theory. Of course, that's utter nonsense. Absolute nonsense. And in fact, no editor worth his salt is not a person of very strong conviction, and not a person who, one way and another, works to impose his convictions on other people. What I found difficult was not becoming an advocate. What I found difficult was continuing to pretend to a neutrality, especially in book publishing. You know, there you are in commerce, and in commerce you are supposed to make no judgments other than commercial ones. That too, of course, is nonsense. Very few people in book publishing ever achieve that kind of neutrality. Nevertheless, one is supposed to do so. And I found it increasingly difficult for me to do so, because all I really wanted to do was not to publish books and make profit from them. All I really wanted to do was to see to it that the kinds of arguments and the kinds of descriptions and the kinds of discussions that I wanted in the air and that I felt there was a shortage of should come into being. In that sense, I suppose one's job with a committee like the Committee for the Free World is not all that different at bottom from being an editor, which is to say I am constantly driving people to say things and to write things. I nag them, I pester them to get these things done. So in that sense, I suppose there is a kind of editorial function here.
Well, the the emotion that you express, the feeling toward the United States, is one that's not heard frequently in America today. It's now 1988. Did you have the same kind of sensitivity, say, 30 years ago?
No, 30 years ago I was very careless. I've always been a patriotic person, and I hope I have always been sufficiently grateful for the freedoms and the privileges and the luxuries, and particularly the political luxuries that have been extended to me in my life, including then. But I was careless. In 1958, we all thought that the United States of America was endlessly powerful, and that everything was going to be all right. We thought of it as a kind of rock, and we could pound up against it if we wanted to, and no harm would be done. Well, by 1968, we had learned to think very differently about that. And when I say we, I mean that there really are a whole group of us. You say this is a sentiment you don't often hear expressed in the United States. That is partly true, I think, but that doesn't mean that we're not around expressing it. It just means that at the moment we suffer from a slight shortage of access.
And is it true that there are people who feel it who don't express it?
Well, there are those. There are always those. Of course, you see, the university is a very good case in point here. The university is an institution which is now completely under the domination of left thinking, but I don't even think it's thinking. I think it's obedience to leftist culture. There are people who know and who will tell you that they would suffer very great sanctions if they stood up and spoke out. And so what they tend to do is applaud others who stand up and speak out, and then they sneak over to you in the corner and shake your hand and say, I couldn't agree with you more. If you detect a slight note of bitterness, it's there, because I don't think that people are ever going to become self-respecting and have freedom, not even in American universities, unless they stand up for themselves a little bit better than a lot of these people do. But it is true that the university has become a place which really does go farther than anyone to smother dissent.
Totally contrary to what one thinks the university should
do. That is right. It is totally contrary. The universities collapsed. In the 1960s, student radicals ganged together, and they also brought into their fold a lot of students, the kind we call ideological cannon fodder. There were students who really had no particular opinions, but who did sort of serve to come along for the ride. And they attacked the universities, and they said to the universities, everything you have to teach us is a lot of crap, and it's irrelevant. You remember the word irrelevant?
Mm-hmm.
And it's no good, and it's useless, and it's all in the service of this hideous society. And they said all those things. They were kids. At least a lot of them were kids. And the university responded like so many permissive parents and said, you know what? You're right. You're absolutely right. What can we do to make you happy? And in responding this way, in collapsing in front of whatever was a student, I guess you could over-dignify it by calling it rebellion. The university had brought itself low, and it remains low. And it may be low for decades and decades, maybe for half a century, because institutions don't survive very well when they can find no way to stand on the ground of their own principles.
You've been an author and an editor. Which role do you find most satisfying? If you were to go back to one or the other, which would you choose?
Well, being an author, obviously, is more satisfying in the long run, in the sense that you've got something on your mind, and then when you get finished, there are these pages in print, and they belong to you. So I suppose in that sense it is far more satisfying. On the other hand, in the near term, writing is a misery for most people. There are some who really like it. I mean, I have a friend named Joseph Epstein, who is a simply wonderful writer. And when you read him, you know that he actually likes to sit down and do it. Most of us don't. I think it's lonely work and it's very anxious making. And in that sense, in the short term, it was much more fun for me to get my hands on a little manuscript called Wealth and Poverty by a writer named George Gilder than ever it was to sit down and slog my way through my own.
And kind of help him slog his way through it without having to pay quite the price. In a recent issue of Contentions, which is a monthly collection of essays, which you publish here at
yes.
the Committee for the Free World, you printed a book review by Sidney Hook. In that review, Dr. Hook made the following statement, quote, when an intelligent person is chided for changing his mind, he replies to his interlocutor, when I discover that I am wrong, I change my mind. What do you do? Unquote. Do most authors meet that test that Dr. Hook puts forward?
Well, if you put the question that way, do most authors, I honestly don't know the answer. What I know is there are some people who have, I suppose you would call it the honesty. It's something more than honesty. It's something more like spiritual responsibility to say that they were wrong when they were wrong. And there are some others who will never do this. Never. I remember, you know, I remember very well. I came of age politically in the early 50s, which means the McCarthy era. And there were lots of ex-communists around, and they were being heard from then because it was the McCarthy era. And lots of them, I noticed, it was almost kind of amusing, were saying, I was right then to be a communist, and I'm right now not to be a communist. Which is just another way of saying, wherever I happen to find myself is the right place to be. Now, this probably offers people a great deal of comfort if they talk that way, but on the other hand, it's not very good, I think, either for their intellectual condition, or if it doesn't sound too pompous, may I say, for their moral condition to do that.
In the continuing conflict of ideas, which you, in all of these various roles that you've played, have certainly been involved in, have you come to recognize any rhetorical or debate tactics that are particularly effective? Any advice to people who want to put forward ideas?
Well, again, I'm not sure I know what the word effective means in this case, because that is something that you have to measure by measuring other people.
Yes.
I do know quite a bit by now about engaging in arguments and the one thing that is absolutely necessary for maintaining one's own strength in an argument is to say exactly what one means and take the consequences for it. That sounds like a truism. In fact, it sounds like a kind of boring maxim book adage or something.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you really pay attention to this, you will see that not many people do it. Not many people do it. They are constantly hoping that they can, on the one hand, say something that others might find unpleasant, and on the other hand, ward off any unpleasantness by covering their tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes mud. And what it also makes is weakness.
Leonard Reed, I think, made a point that's related to that, which is that one has to first start by being sure what one's own position is.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, that is certainly, that is the beginning, but of course, that in itself takes the most courage, actually.
To confront how you really feel.
To find your, and to clarify in your own mind, and to be really clear about what it is, that takes a lot of courage, because it's easier not to, that's why. But you know, I meet with kids on campus, and a lot of these kids, like the Committee for the Free World, are taking dissident positions, and particularly in the university. They are conservative kids, let's say, or that's what they call themselves, although some of them are really not so conservative. But in the university context, they certainly feel that they're conservative. And I talk to them, and they're young, and they get very frightened because their professor, not only their fellow students, but even their professors can get extremely nasty with them. And the advice I always give them, always, is to say, do not apologize. Whatever you do, do not get up and defend yourself. Don't defend yourself for being a person who loves his country by saying, you know, really, I'm a nice guy. Never defend yourself.
Interesting advice. I'll directly admit I have a total sympathy for your ideas. I also enjoy your prose.
Why, thank you. You know, there's nothing you can say to a writer that's better than that. You can say he's dead wrong and he's crazy, as long as you say you like his prose.
Well, I'll go a step, perhaps even the ultimate. I wish I could write that well. When did you begin writing?
Well, I suppose every writer begins writing when he's a kid. When did I seriously...
When did you begin writing?
Oh, I guess I was in my early 20s.
In college or after college?
Oh, well after.
Where did you go to college?
I went to the University of Minnesota for a year, and I went to NYU for a semester. That's it.
That's it?
That's it. So you can see that it took me a while to collect the nerve
I understand.
To start writing.
When you started in college, did you have a goal that you were working toward, or were you just, well, I'll go and see what I'm interested in?
Oh, I didn't really have a goal. I suppose if you asked me, I would have said I did, but it would have certainly been something that sounded like a great deal of nonsense, like, I want to be a philosopher, mm-hmm. or something like that. You know, it was utterly meaningless nonsense. I just went to be a liberal arts major, I guess.
You're a mother.
Oh, yes.
Four children.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. And a grandmother. That's much more important. I have 8 grandchildren.
Oh, that's delightful. It's interesting that 15 years ago, I probably would have assumed you're a mother without knowing or having that information provided.
Why is that?
Well, because I my background is one in which I assume that a goal and therefore the likely outcome for every woman is to be a mother, and for every man to be a father. But I'd have to say that now I have a few mental alarms. I have some things built into me now that prevent me, a kind of an early warning system that resists those kinds of assumptions. Is that symbolic of desirable social change in your mind?
Oh, God, it's just absolutely a disaster. That's what it is. You're talking about the fact that you now, there's some question in your mind as to whether you can take for granted that every woman wants to be a mother. See, that's wrong. Every woman does want to be a mother. You can still go on taking that for granted. But young women have had their minds so, their heads so filled with garbage that it can no longer be taken for granted that they find out that they want to be a mother until they are well into their 30s. And that's really very sad. And even then, they're all mixed up about it. But that's because this wonderful movement for social change came along in the late 1960s. And it said to women, we are going to call ourselves feminists, and we are for your liberation. And the way we are going to liberate you is by telling you that you are no good, that your lives are no good, that you've been brainwashed all your life, that you can never possibly succeed in this world unless they give you very special treatment, and that they owe it to you because you are some kind of slave. And the only way you can prove you're not some kind of slave is by pursuing a career and not enslaving yourself to some man and some bunch of children who imprison you in the house. And they began talking that way, these women, the liberators of women. They now deny they said such things, but it's not true. They did say them. They did. Like many people, they now wish to have no responsibility for what they actually did and said. But they said this, and they said it to young women in the best universities who came out for no reason, seething with resentment, full of hostility to young men, full of hostility to, I don't know what, to the world, with a big chip on their shoulder, for nothing. It's taken them a long time to recover from this. That movement was a movement against nature. That's what it was. It was a movement against women's nature, against their better nature. Now, if you said things like this, and I did say them at the time, I was an early and vociferous opponent of women's liberation. And if you said it then, and if you say it now, it is assumed you mean then that women are supposed to be pregnant and barefoot all their lives and hang out in the kitchen. That, of course, is not true.
It's obviously not true in your case.
No, it's not true in my case, and it's not true in lots of other people's cases, and it certainly has got to be said. See, one of the problems with the generation of the 60s is that they believe that the world was invented the day they were born. This is an idea that we, their parents, did plant in their minds. But certainly there were plenty of career women before women's liberation attempted to liberate them. But and this was not a movement for equal pay, for equal work. There was nobody opposed to that. But it was a movement which wanted to blame all the difficulties that these women were having on somebody else, society, nature, men, that everything they did, everything that was there difficult for them was because they were victims. Now, if you're a person and you got a trouble, you got a problem, you're worried about something, or you're anxious, and somebody comes along and says to you, baby, naturally you feel that way. You're a victim. Your heart is going to rise up in response to this. You want to think you're a victim, because then that means it's not your fault, anything you do. So there was this terrible assault on men and on womanhood and on motherhood. And as I say, it took a very, very long time for people to recover from it. They're only just beginning to do it now. But you will find now that young women, everywhere there are these stories which are appearing. The young women in the law firms are discovering to their astonishment that when they have babies, they don't really feel like leaving their babies 2 months after they're born and going back to the office. And the women's movement is now storming around demanding leave, maternity leave, and paternity leave, and all these things, so that women can have children and be in the office. And then lo and behold, lots of them actually don't want to go back to the office. They actually like to hang around with these babies. And not only that, but in 15 years, there's hardly been anybody to explain to them, not their mothers, and certainly not their teachers, and not the popular culture, and not the magazines they read, and not the newspapers they read, nothing to say to them, you know what, there is something to this baby's business. They're actually rather fetching. And when you have one of them, you will discover that you actually love it quite a lot and are amused by it, that these babies will give you pleasure. In fact, more pleasure than you ever actually thought you might ever have in your life, of a kind you never anticipated having. There was nobody to say this to these young women. So naturally, they were very puzzled when they discovered this. And now, of course, thanks to this wonderful social change we are going through, now when they stay home and look after their babies, they feel extremely guilty.
That's what I was going to say. They're still made to feel guilty.
They are made to feel guilty. They think there must be something wrong with them, because actually they don't hate motherhood. They love motherhood. And they'd rather look after their children than go and spend 60 hours a week crawling their way to the top of some terrific law firm. And that the women's movement used to say that all women were sheep, passive sheep. That's why they allowed themselves to be herded into the suburbs and there to graze and produce babies that would be consumers for capitalist society. Well, if you ever saw a bunch of sheep, you can see them now. The young girls getting out of college, herding themselves into law school.
Yes, it's a fascinating. I have a niece who's fascinated with being a lawyer, for no rational reason.
Yes. Well, in my time, it was publishing, and there it was supposed to be much more glamorous to sit all day long reading, proofreading galley sheets than to be home with a baby.
I noticed that that the maternity leave almost is rationalized by also asking for paternity leave.
Yes.
Now, right. Obviously, I don't think there's ever been a time when the feminists claim that there wasn't a physical sexual difference between man and woman. They may have liked to have, but they had to admit to that.
Yes.
But they have continuously and to this day insisted that beyond that obvious physical difference, there is no other difference. There is no basis for behavioral differences, etc.
Yes.
Do you agree with that?
Well, of course I don't agree with that. First of all, if that were true, think of how boring the world would be, and how dreary life would be. And I'm not just making a sexual allusion here. I mean the whole world would be terribly boring if men and women were the same. Of course they're not the same. And not only that, but children's lives would be so completely flattened, and I fear are getting flattened, in fact, by the idea that a daddy is a mommy and a mommy is a mommy or a mommy is a daddy and that there really is essentially no difference between these two things. That's a terrible thing.
And what do you think is the most significant behavioral difference? Can you point to one kind of behavioral characteristic that really is strongly different in men and women?
Well, there must be many. The fact that women conceive and give birth to babies, if we just start with the most primitive, simple definition, already has got to make a difference. Because what women are involved in is the day-to-day, the dailiness of care. And great women novelists are great precisely because of this connection to the dailiness. And great women social theorists are great because of their connection to the dailiness. They're just closer to the ground. And you could say on that account, if you wanted to, that is why in some areas, they have a lot more ordinary sense than men. It's called mother wit. It's not for nothing that it's called mother wit. And men are adventurers of a different kind. And that's what makes the world an interesting place.
I was thinking about it in the context of my own children. And I have two grandchildren. I have ways to go yet to catch you. But you say dailiness. That's interesting because mm-hmm. I thought of the difference in that sense as that the kind of total focus where that my wife would have toward our children, and I love my children and I've always been very comfortable with them at all ages. But even so, if I think about it, I compartmentalize. There are times when I am prepared to be a father and close to the children, and there are other times when I'm not comfortable with that. I want to go in another direction. And my sense is women don't do that. They don't compartmentalize. Children are children now, today, tomorrow, this minute, the next minute, every sense.
Well, that may be so. Of course, that's one of the things that the women's movement carried on the most about, that wasn't true, that you had your space and your life and you see you didn't do this. Why do people expect mothers to do this? And of course, it's all nonsense. I mean, if you look, you have children, I have children, and it's even easier to see with one's grandchildren because one isn't anxious about one's grandchildren and one isn't stuck with the responsibility
right.
for their welfare. So you can just sit and watch them. And if anybody watches little children, from birth, let's say. Well, all right, birth is perhaps too radical. From 1 year up and does not see complete difference between little boys and little girls, which has nothing to do with how they're socialized or what clothes they're put in or anything. They're just different. They develop differently. They think differently. They're interested in different things. They behave differently. And you can begin to see it. I mean, there are all different ways you can describe this. Little boys, for instance, are totally pure of heart. They can be violent. They can be nasty. They can be difficult. They are rarely sneaky, and they are rarely manipulative. And little girls can be absolutely perfect little angels and will manipulate the daylights out of you from morning till night.
Yes. Yes. Great. Have there been any decisive winners or losers in this battle that's gone on over the last decade and more on the women's rights?
Well, I think there can't be any winners, and I think there are many losers. However, hopefully we might recover from this, because if you attempt to do something that is so violating of people's natural feelings, it doesn't last long. You can't get away with it. Sooner or later, nature will make its claims. But of course there have been losers. There have been two sets of losers. First of all, for one set, let's take men and women. They've been losers. Men cannot thrive when women are not thriving, and vice versa. Women cannot thrive and have a satisfactory life if their men are not in good condition. And if they don't understand this, they are going to have many sorrows before they learn this. We are on earth together. And we really do depend on one another, both sexes, for our well-being. And if war is declared, nobody benefits. So men and women is the first set of victims, and children is the next. Children these days are torn. Their fates are torn between being neglected on one end or being driven on the other. Mm-hmm. In either case, there's something very, very artificial in their lives these days. I have nieces and nephews and neighbors and so on, and all I want to say to them, these are all young, aspiring, middle-class couple, I guess you call them yuppies. And all I want to say to them is, cool down. Cool off. Leave these kids alone. Don't start worrying about their matriculation to Harvard. And don't press them. And don't examine them so. And don't make them extensions of your ambition. It's very hard for them not to do that because of the way life itself has been represented to these people.
Given the chance, would you personally alter how you've dealt with career and motherhood?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my God, would I? I never found a satisfactory answer to that question. Never. And so the first thing I always want to say to career women who are mothers is don't fret if you can't find a satisfactory answer, because there is none. There really is none. I mean, no one could have tried harder than I. And I am very sorry. I went back to work when my youngest child was 3.5 years old and was in a very good school until 3:30 in the afternoon. A very good school, where he was lovingly looked after. It was a school that people in New York City killed to get their children into. And then when he came home, there was a housekeeper at home, and just one housekeeper, and she was a darling girl who loved him and whom he loved. And now I have decided that 3.5 was too young anyway. I mean, it was under the most ideal circumstances. And I bitterly regret that I did it. My son, who is the child involved here, and I have had these arguments ever since, in which I say, I bitterly regret having done that, and he always says to me, oh, come on, forget about it. He's 27, so he thinks it's time. There was no harm done, he insists.
In an article you wrote, I must interrupt because it's interesting. I want to remind you of this. It relates to what you just said, though. You said something that may be, as little children I want to say, no fair, but it is the truth. In other words, you, in a sense, you're saying, you know, you don't like it that you haven't been able to find a better answer.
Yes.
But it is the truth. It is reality.
That's right. That's right. Well, look, the secret is that having children is a career. And having a career is a career. And if you do both, you are someone who undertakes two careers. Now, that is possible. It's possible to do that. There are a lot of people who do it. There are men who do it. My husband does it. He has a full-time job, and then in addition to that, he writes, which means that every spare moment of his life is involved in work. It's doable, but what it requires, what the pursuit of two careers requires, is a lot of energy, for one thing, and a high level of capacity to get yourself organized, and a lot of self-discipline. Now, not everybody has that much energy, and not everybody has that much self-discipline and organization, nor is it a virtue. It's not a moral virtue to have it. It's just, it's a quality some people have, but you better have it if you want to do both, because otherwise you will walk around embittered by both.
But if you don't have it, and you can possibly recognize that, don't feel guilty about it.
Oh, of course not. Of course not. Because if you are, why on earth anyone should feel guilty about being a mother? It's utterly absurd. It used to be claimed that women who went to work were made to feel guilty because they weren't looking after their children. I think that was a lot of nonsense. I don't think they were. Maybe in 1870, they were. But when I grew up, they weren't. They weren't made to feel guilty. But who are being made to feel guilty now are women who are looking after their children. And I think that is a crime.
Do you see any evidence that today's teenagers will do a better job of handling the problem?
I don't see today's teenagers very much. My own children are too far grown, and my grandchildren are as yet too young. The one thing I learned in the 1960s is not to believe what anybody tells you about the young, is not to believe anything you do not see with your own eyes. Because in the 1960s, they were telling us these kids are wonderful. They are the best, the most wonderful, idealistic, terrific generation that ever lived. And what I saw with my own eyes was that they were getting pale and sick, that they were neurasthenic, that they were running away from the world, that they were frightened, that they were at sea. And ever since that time, I have not believed what anybody said. So I'm not sure what the teenagers of today are like.
Here's another question. I think you may have a much sharper feeling about it. Has the United States as a nation been weakened by this movement, by the feminist movement?
Oh, of course it's been weakened. Of course it's been weakened. Here you have, it's really an anomaly. Here you have this marvelous country bursting with energy. You want to see energy, get in a car and drive through the state of Nebraska and Kansas and Iowa even. Just drive. Just go on one of those big highways and you will see things growing and moving and people growing and moving all around you. this is a country which is full of energy, which is doing nothing these days but attacking itself and talking about the impossibility of life, talking about how there's a disaster just around the corner. This all comes from a sense that things are not well with us. And the first ground of well-being is that thing that men and women make together. It's called a family. And the family is the greatest invention of the human spirit. Not because it's so wonderful and sweet, and not because everybody is nice to everybody, and not because it's full of love. Because sometimes, to tell the truth, and we all know it, families can be a royal pain in the neck. But because it is an institution in which the needs of men and women and children are somehow adjudicated and somehow the mode is found in which people can help one another and bring to one another what they need, and in which children know, every child in a family knows that he is vitally important to someone else. And this is something that children really need to know. So families are absolutely bedrock of the sense of well-being in this country. So what we have here is a country which is actually very well off. A funny example of this, not so funny, peculiar example of this, is the state of the American economy. It's booming along, and every single day, all you can hear is these terrible predictions that any minute now, the country is going to collapse. It can't go on. Tomorrow, the economy is, you think it's stronger today, it's producing jobs, it's doing this, it's doing it. Tomorrow, disaster is coming. Now, I maintain that this inability to feel the strength in this country and to husband the strength of this country and to appreciate it and to love it and to cherish it and to defend it and to be cheerful about it, this all derives from the fact that Americans have been bereft of any kind of feeling of well-being in the most arbitrary, terrible way. And it's sinful, is what it is. And that America's middle-class women, because don't make any mistake about this, that's who it is. That's who that movement is. It's middle-class women, that America's middle-class women, who live longer, healthier, better-looking, stronger, who see all their children live and survive. They don't have to give birth to 17 children in order to have four of them survive. They don't have to stand by and watch their children being ravaged by diseases. No one ever had it so good. And that they should get up and compare themselves with the condition of blacks in the South under slavery it's a sin, is what it is. It's a sin, and sins get punished.
And we're seeing some of the cost of
that. We are indeed.
Do you find the same consequences resulting from other sectors of what I would call this civil rights growth industry that seems to be coming?
Well, it's a civil rights growth industry. It's not got anything to do with civil rights at all. It's a group of people who are battening on the difficulties and the discomfitures of others and who are making very big careers, keeping these discomfitures, helping to keep these discomfitures alive. I don't know how long it would take otherwise, under proper conditions, for blacks to catch up. They had a lot of catching up to do. I don't know how long it would have taken. It probably would have taken a lot less time than anyone felt. Because by the time the structure of discrimination had given away in this country, the feelings of discrimination were already crumbling as well. But it would have taken time. Instead of allowing it to take time, what happened was a group of professional disaster mongers who screamed racism in the face of every single condition, in the face of every single problem, who, again, just the way the women's movement turned to the women of this country and said, every difficulty you have is because you're a woman. They turned to blacks who were just beginning to feel their way and said to them, everything that's bothering you is racism. Now, just as in the case of the women, it sets people back. It's going to take not all the blacks, after all, quietly. There are the blacks we don't hear about. They never get mentioned. They're like the pro-American intellectuals I was talking about. There are lots of them around. You just don't hear about them, who are doing fine and who are moving into the middle class and actually on schedule. But then there are lots of others. They are suffering from all kinds of terrible breakdowns and social pathology. And to say to them that everything that is wrong with them is due to racism and that the government has got to find the cure, and if the government doesn't find the cure, it's because the government doesn't want to and is nothing but a bunch of racists. To do this to such people is a crime.
You've also written, particularly recently, about what at first glimpse is a totally different area of concern, and that's foreign policy and the whole question of the Soviet-U.S. Conflict. I'm interested to know if those two elements have any relationship. Are obviously, to the extent that these movements weaken the United States, they are to the benefit of any enemy of any kind. Is there any tie in here? Is there any relationship between the two areas?
Yes, of course there is. Indeed there is. There are two things that govern our relations with the Soviet Union. One is the question of military security, and the other is the question of the good society, if you will. Anti-Americanism has actually undermined both of these things very much. We are not permitted to defend ourselves. We are not permitted to have a defense. Obviously, we do have a defense, and obviously the voters of the United States wanted us to have a very strong defense. That's why they twice, by a landslide, elected Ronald Reagan. But this defense of our country is not permitted to be given any confirmation, not in the movies, not in the newspapers, not on television. It is almost as if the people who wear the uniforms that protect us in this country are our primary enemies. So that is one attitude. We are not allowed to do this. And we're not even allowed to think about it all around us. So the people who understand in a very simple way that they want the country to have a strong defense and that therefore they voted for Ronald Reagan for that reason, among others, receive no confirmation for the rightness of their view all around them. That is, except for a few cheap politicians who wish to pander to their votes and who say it isn't that we aren't entitled to a defense, it's that we don't need a defense. And this is where the new romance with the Soviet Union comes in. The Soviet Union is now in trouble. It is in dire economic trouble. It faces the possibility of the breakdown, at least to some extent, of its empire. The nationalities inside are giving it trouble. The Afghans gave it more trouble than it expected, and so on. What is the response? What is the response of the leadership in the United States and the press and the people who make up all the national conversation? What is the response of the people to this difficulty that the Soviet Union is in? Is it good? That's what our policy has been after for a long time. Now let us hold firm and hold steady, and maybe we will see the passing away of this monstrosity. Is it that? It is not that at all. It's okay, that's terrific. Well, we're rid of that responsibility. And after all, it's simply wonderful what is going on in the Soviet Union. You find people coming back from the Soviet Union telling you how wonderful it is that the Soviet Union is no longer governed by a mass murderer. You see, the point about Comrade Gorbachev is that he's not a mass murderer like Stalin. And they will come back singing his praises because he's not a mass murderer. And haven't got a kind word to say. Not for Ronald Reagan, not for Jimmy Carter, not for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, not for the Attorney General of the United States. You would think that the Attorney General of the United States was the head of the KGB, and that the head of the KGB is now a wonderful hero of freedom and democracy. Well, the reason that we are doing this and responding in this way, which is not to greet the discomfiture of the Soviets with great joy on the grounds that a lot of people in the world, in Eastern Europe and in Southeast Asia and everywhere else, will benefit mightily if the Soviet Union is in trouble. Instead, we say, that's good, that lets us off the hook, now we can fold our hands and we don't have to do anything. And the reason that people are so eager to write off their responsibilities is because their sense of rightness has been undermined all the way down to the bottom. We are not entitled to hold ourselves superior to the Soviets. That is the message. And it is absurd. There is nothing arrogant or jingo about the idea that free men living in a free and democratic society have a superior society and are therefore 1,000 times luckier than those who have the misfortune to have inherited a totalitarian state, which, if we only hold firm, might be in the condition of disintegration.
And in the same sense, fathers and mothers lacking the conviction that their honest and sometimes failing efforts at being parents and part of the community is somehow a trivial pursuit. That's the relationship.
Yes, yes.
Whew. Well, do we have any reason for believing that our grandchildren will share a more free and prosperous world than we do?
Well, I would like to think so. I'm not really sure. One thing I am sure of, however, if our grandchildren do live in a world which in which there are more and more people enjoying freedom and prosperity than there are now, it will be because of the brave people in places like Poland and Hungary and Czechoslovakia, who are willing to risk everything, and the Soviet Union, who are prepared to go to jail for what they believe, and who are the ones who are, to the eternal shame of this country, I think they are the ones who are showing the way to how to have a free world. And I would hope that my grandchildren, when they are teenagers, will know and will remember to salute those people and will understand how much they owe to them.